You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This episode could contain profanity. It's up to me, I guess. Your Saturday could contain a GIST newsletter. To sign up for it, our once-a-week newsletter, go to slate.com/gistnews. It's Thursday, January 17th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Washington Post headline, "She wields the knife." Wait, I thought Nini already lost in the Last Chance Kitchen on Top Chef. Oh no, these aren't the restaurant wars. The Boosh is not amused. This is the very real issue of power, politics, and Pelosi. She wields the knife. Here's the full headline. She wields the knife. The House Speaker's confrontational approach to the president has united Democrats and cheered liberals, but it carries risks. Ahead of the 2020 campaign risks, let us check in on those risks. So, the article says, in the 2 weeks since she's reclaimed the Speaker's gavel, Pelosi has moved aggressively to leverage her decades of congressional experience to needle, belittle, and undercut Trump with swipes at his competence and even his masculinity. Just one quibble, and it's the word belittle. To belittle would be to make someone little. This is more of a re-little, i.e. revealing how small and petty and little Trump naturally is. But let us continue with the article. But Pelosi's challenge to Trump also comes with a degree of risk for her and for Democrats. The more she becomes the face of Trump's opposition, the more Republicans will probably use her unpopularity nationally to label vulnerable House members as Pelosi clones, a potentially potent line of attack against sitting lawmakers who cast votes in lockstep with party leaders. No, no. What if Republicans use Pelosi to smear the Democratic Party? What would that sound like?
Pelosi's wrong. It's time to change Washington. The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Well, it might sound like that, or it might sound like this.
In Washington, he'd be one of Nancy Pelosi's sheep.
And if those ads were taken out throughout the country, what would be the result electorally?
CNN can now project that Democrats will win the majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Jake, this is a huge win for the Democrats, a huge setback for the president and for the Republicans.
It is.
Why do I think that Pelosi fears the prospect of getting smeared in a Republican ad like Giuliani fears getting booked on cable news? I understand that conflict equals drama, but I do not think the particular conflict that Nancy Pelosi is feeling is an internal one. Ooh, do I continue to oppose Trump quite forcefully and effectively? The Democrats saddled Trump with owning the shutdown. Schumer did that in the Oval Office meeting. It was the most effective piece of political jujitsu I may have ever seen. Sure, the opponent was a man baby, but it was still a vicious takedown. And since then, I honestly do not think Pelosi has misstepped once, not that I could see. Trump seemed not to have done much right in the meantime. So if there's any conflict, it's all external. Believe me, Pelosi is not second guessing all she has done to cause the president to tear up the itinerary she put together in a fit of peak presidentialness. So tonight on Top Chef, Nancy Pelosi wields the knife, and I would say she couldn't have a firmer grip on the handle. On today's show, more spieling about Nancy, Donald, and shutdowns. No Afghanistan for you, lady. But first, they show up as a funny cat hanging in there, or success kid, or a boyfriend who's distracted, or Homer Simpson disappearing into a bush. They seem cute. And then we get Brexit or Bolsonaro or some other real-world electoral disaster that frankly seems incommensurate with that cute little computerized combo of text and pics. Aha! This, my friends, is how we go from memes to movements, as analyzed in our forthcoming discussion with Ann Chowmina. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So Anshul Mina is a thinker and an artist who talks about technology and talks about the internet and writes about it. And I read something that she wrote in The Economist where she was pointing out that more than, say, rhetoric or even TV ads, memes are holding sway over politics. And I said, true, as far as it goes. And then her book hit my desk and has this great cover. There's a llama. There's a kitten looking over the cover. The name of the book is Memes to Movements, How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. And I said to myself, what a just captivating visual. I'm going to dive into this book. And then I realized, hours into it, I got memed, didn't I? The visual, the fast twitch muscle visual is the thing that got me enthralled. So, of course, I had to have her on. Hello, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me here, Mike.
Tell me how you come to this, mostly as someone who was looking at protest and the usefulness of the internet to give marginalized people their voice.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it really is grounded in my interests in just creativity and social media. I used to live in New York and did a lot of social media art performances, explored how people did creative expression on social media. But then it got really interesting when I started to see how marginalized, disempowered people were then using that same kind of affordances and power to advocate for themselves and shape both national and international media narratives.
Are there any stark differences between the use of memes and the internet for information versus disinformation?
You know, what's really striking is I'm involved in both. I'm involved in research with the book, specifically around activism, especially progressives and anti-authoritarian movements, and then disinformation. And what you see is actually a very striking similarity in how influence is achieved online. Claire Warren and Hossein Darakhshan produced a report called Information Disorder for the Council of Europe, and they noted that disinformation operates based on strong emotions, repetition, strong visuals, the ability to disseminate information across networks. And I said, wait a minute, that's a lot of how meme culture works more generally.
Yeah.
And the larger theme of the book is that memes have power. And memes can influence people. And so I think it's really, really important that researchers, that people in media engage with it, understand it, really dive into how it works. Because if you're not engaging on it, you're basically ceding the meme territory to anyone else who wants to be utilizing it.
Right. So if you're an anti-fascist government protester, we don't want your meme to be your doctrine, right? Maybe you could point someone to what you believe, but it can usefully get the word out. But if you're also working for, if you're Fancy Bear or Cozy Bear working for the IRA, the Russian version, the meme could do the same thing in a much more pernicious way.
That's right. And I think, you know, your point about the book cover is a great example. You know, we have learned over time not to judge a book by its cover, to engage, to look at who else is talking about it, who is the author behind it, what are their motivations, who is the publisher, what is the person actually saying. And in some ways, we need a new kind of memetic literacy for this age to understand messages by their meme cover.
Right. So if you were to teach a course on this, deconstructing the meme, what would you tell us to look for?
You know, in the book, I dive into a few things. One is the kind of form, the visuals of it. What are the old symbologies that this meme is drawing from? What are the cultural tropes that it's kind of pulling at, and what are the emotions it's trying to sell? And then secondly is also the narrative. What is the narrative it's building? How is it part of a larger media discourse? And so in what way is it trying to influence you and influence us? And even more specifically, which networks is it really resonating in? Who is the audience in this kind of world of many different types of audiences? We need a more complex understanding of who audiences can be, because they can be anyone.
Okay, so that would be good. Let me take them maybe one by one, or a couple of parts of that. It does seem that a lot of memes that are shared can be used for good or ill. Like, you have the, it's a big screenshot and kind of big words and
big
bubbles
words
are around
it. Yeah, the image
it.
Macro. Yeah,
image
that's
macro,
a type
right?
of very popular type of meme.
So I've seen 100 with the most interesting man in the world, Dos Equis, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you could label that something to the right, something to the left, something that's this great truth that needs to be said, or something that's this huge lie.
Yep.
So then how do I go about that first thing that you said with understanding the typography, understanding where it comes from? Yeah. It can be applied to anything. They're very malleable.
Yeah, they are very malleable. And that's what makes it really tricky. And because, especially because they move so fast, and then they can be shared and understood in different communities in different ways. And so you take a look at that image, you understand what is the meme culture it's a part of, right? The Dos Equis meme, right? It's part of this larger, like, advertising ecosystem, part of a larger meme about masculinity, about how, you know, what it means to be interesting. And then you look at the text itself. And often, you know, in kind of West, and this is interesting because image macros are most common in American and Western meme culture. So you look at that, you look at the font, you look at the story it's trying to tell, and then what are the values it's projecting? And how is it resonating? How many likes and retweets and shares is it getting? It's hard to do that. I want to note that. It's really hard to do that. But that is how you understand and deep dive into these memes, and that's what I do in the book.
But it seems to me that what the thing that Twitter can do is they could let anyone publish a meme, but if it's very clickable, they could give you the stats about where this is popular from. So if it was, you know, the summer of 2016, you saw this stupid frog that you didn't know what he meant. But if you clicked on the stats and you saw the circle of where this was coming from, that might alert you that Pepe is not benign.
I think, you know, it's a really important point. I think a lot of the internet right now is designed to take away context from everything that's online. And sometimes it's useful. But so much of journalism is specifically about bringing context to work, right? To messages, to what's out there. And I think platforms have a more important role to play in bringing back context. They've been so focused on making things easy to use, the whole design ethos of don't make me think. Maybe we should bring back some design thinking that encourages people to understand the context in which memes circulate.
Yeah. I mean, context is always good. It's always something to embrace. I don't know that the ecosystem, I don't know that the financial incentives are there. Sure, the New York Times, the Washington Post, two or three players who probably get paid attention to by the people who are already paying attention to everyone else. I'm trying to think, you know, will the nightly news cover a meme and tell you what it means so that our parents or frightened grandparents understand it? Will, I don't know who else out there can step in and become a different organism than they have been before? Because it seems like that's what you're saying. We know that the New York Times is going to provide context. Will Reddit do that? Will BuzzFeed do that? You know, will the new purveyors of information do that?
That's the big challenge, the big question of today. I think you've nailed it, though. I think it's the attention economy is part of what's driving the lack of context, right? The fact that strong emotions drive a lot of what gets us to stay on the internet, It gets it to engage, and therefore gives data that then supports an ad model. It is largely incentivized for emotion, for reaction. And so without a deeper understanding of the business model, especially around the attention economy, it's going to be really hard to incentivize bringing context into our internet experiences.
You, as you trace, you know, your interest in this, you do a lot of work with the protesters against or activists against the Chinese government.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you get into that?
Yes, it was back in 2011. I had the chance to work at the studio of Ai Weiwei, working on an exhibition in Korea that he was curating. But as a result, I was around a lot of the activism. And that's actually what got me interested in this topic, because they were using memes to evade censorship, to shape international narratives about what was happening in China. And I just found that such an interesting experience that I decided to really dive in more deeply into this.
In this cat and mouse game, this kitten on a treadmill and mouse game, is the Chinese government good at suppressing memes online? I mean, we don't want to pat them on the back and say good job, but are they effective in their goals?
Steadily getting much more and more effective. So back in 2011, the mechanisms of censorship were humans and algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
So keyword search terms specifically. And so if you tried to say the word Ai Weiwei on Chinese social media, it could easily be suppressed because it's easy to find that. And so what activists did is that they used images, they remixed his name. They used
science. You mean they're sort of codes, essentially.
That's exactly
right. But the Chinese language or the different Chinese languages allow this probably more than English.
Yeah, it allowed for a certain type of remix, right?
Yeah.
And it's a tonal language, so you change tones, you change meanings. And so it is part of a long history of punning in Chinese language as well. So so people are just able to mix and remix.
Yeah.
Over time, the government has hired many more censors, has improved its algorithms, and even more importantly, as a research by Gary King at Harvard has really found, is that they're actually employing people to shape discourse online.
So I think of it as, yes, they give rise to or they give voice to marginalized groups. But then what happens is all groups see the effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
and maybe they even begin to see themselves as marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
So now white supremacists are doing the same things that Ai Weiwei did.
Mm-hmm.
You write, interestingly, about Uganda, which I know some things about. I have a friend who set up early Ugandan networks. And I think you write mostly positively about hashtag Kony 2012. So to remind people, he was the warlord who used children soldiers, and terrible guy, and he was before the docket of the World Court. But when things really got rolling with him as an issue, I think the people who were mostly behind the meme or the hashtag were a little also behind the facts, and a lot of money was wasted probably, and I don't know, it just seemed like a big exercise in possibly good intentions, but nothing actually coming from it. I look back at it as more of a kind of an indictment of the limits of this sort of hashtag activism or meme use. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a good example of what you just said of contextlessness, right?
Yeah.
That the internet and meme culture can oversimplify to the point of reducing context. And especially when we're talking about an international context where a country like Uganda, I doubt most people can really point it out on a map, right?
Yeah.
Most people in the West, I should say. It's very easy to amplify a narrative or a trope that oversimplifies a very complex situation. And so in the book, I dive into that one and another hashtag that appeared that very same year, which was hashtag Uganda is not Spain.
Yeah.
And the reason I look at those two is that one came from people in Uganda, Uganda is not Spain, in response to an oversimplification. The prime minister of Spain during the economic crisis had texted, I believe, his finance minister and said, you know, don't worry, it'll be okay. Spain is not Uganda. When word got out, Ugandans took to social media, led by Rosebel Kagamira, who's a journalist there, and started tweeting out facts about why Uganda is not Spain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they were doing a little better than Spain by many measures.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right. So you had this these two hashtags as a case study in how both you can oversimplify a story from the outside But then also how that oversimplification can then be challenged through hashtag culture by the very people affected by that oversimplification.
Other than getting into and knowing as much as you can about the underlying facts, were there hallmarks? Could someone look at those memes and say, you know, Kony 2012 raises some red flags, whereas there are hallmarks, there are aspects to the Uganda is not Spain trend that maybe spoke more positively about it?
Yeah, this gets to the other thing about meme culture is understanding where they're coming from.
Right.
And so when you dig into Kony 2012, you see that the organization is coming from San Diego. And yes, they've done work in Uganda, but it's a very different perspective than a literally journalists in Uganda who are trying to respond to international discourse. And so so I do think you still need to dive in. You still need to understand the context. And I spoke with Ugandan researchers to prep for that chapter because I certainly don't fully understand the context. But as a starting point, it's again goes back to the networks. Where are they circulating? Who is pushing the story? And what might be their motivations.
And in Uganda, it's not cats, it's goats that are the cute animal, the go-to.
That appears to be, yeah, that's right. I chatted with folks from Urban Legend, Kampala, it's a humor site, and Ugandan youth in Kampala, the capital. And I was showing them the cats, right? I was showing them cat memes from China and the United States, and they said, oh, that's interesting. They didn't really respond. And over time, I started to realize, well, I was there for three months, and I did see cats around. But I saw a lot of amazing goats, and they're very funny creatures. And so it's like, oh, that's why they like goats so much.
They are, but I've read a pretty compelling explanation of the appeal of cats is that they're ambush predators. So they have quick jump actions, and this is really good for a 2 or 3 second video.
Yeah.
I don't know if goats are that quick.
Well, have you seen the fainting goat memes?
Yes.
they are quirky.
They go down in a hurry.
Yeah, they are quirky creatures.
They are. Yeah. Do you know what I think is going to save us from the memes?
What will save us?
Podcasts.
Podcasts.
They're opposite in so many ways. They're great for dissent.
Mm-hmm.
You get into disagreements, but yeah. in a good way.
Yeah.
You could serve a niche community.
Right.
They're complex.
Yeah.
Also, you can ignore it, but then you're not actually imbibing the information, you know? Like
right.
with memes,
right.
12 could flash across your vision and maybe you absorb 2. With podcasts, you go in and you seek it out. I think podcasts will save us all.
I would agree with that. And the fact that we can have this in-depth conversation, right? That it's not about the sound bites. It's about the dialogue.
Yeah.
But how do you get attention for the podcast? How do people come to learn about it? In so many ways.
You need a crazy cat video.
You need a cat video, right? You need
a goat fainting.
Yep. You need some way to engage people and attract them to that conversation. So if we think of them as the beginning of a discourse, in some ways, maybe they can be helpful.
Ann Chaumina is the author of Memes, Two Movements. Great last name, by the way. On point.
Thank you.
Mina, memes.
Mima, sometimes people say.
Yeah. Memes to Movements, how the world's most viral media is changing social protests and power. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
I'm Dr. Megan Sachs.
And I'm Dr. Amy Sloshberg.
And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings. Our show covers some of the most sinister crimes to take place on or around school campuses, or the cases we discuss have a school-connected theme.
And with the new school year comes an all-new second season of Campus Killings, which will debut on September 16th, 2023.
But if you want to listen to Campus Killings now, you can binge all the episodes from season 1, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
And now the spiel. Donald Trump today struck out against Nancy Pelosi's plan to travel abroad, denying her use of a military aircraft and the protection it entails. It is unclear if he could technically do this. It seems so. He is the commander-in-chief. Let us assume he can. Okay, what did Donald Trump prevent? He prevented Nancy Pelosi from leaving America while Americans, at least some of them who work for the federal government, are desperate to get pay. Imagine the Breitbart headlines if she had left. Nightwing Nancy, or Fox coverage of Pelosi as she breezes through security while regular Americans have to wait in line. Jeanine Pirro, remember, was so intent on smearing Pelosi with dereliction of duty that she reported with disgust that the speaker have been spending some time in actually another part of the United States.
Nancy Pelosi's in Hawaii over the holidays. Now she's in Puerto Rico with a bunch of Democrats and lobbyists, enjoying the sun and partying down there.
And that report, by the way, wasn't even accurate. But now the truth is that Nancy Pelosi wants to go to Brussels and Egypt and Afghanistan, and Trump is there to deny any possible peripatations. What? Nancy Pelosi might be saying. I can't go to Afghanistan? No, Mr. President, no. Let me go to Afghanistan. I need some me time at that one spa they have in Kandahar. Please, Mr. President, please let me have this Afghani jaunt, if only for the suppression of free radicals. And I don't mean the Taliban. My combination skin, it's acting up. The Taliban, as you remember, formed to resist the very lawful and invited presence of the Soviet Union, who were perfectly right to accept their host's invitation. This is the theory as proposed by two sources, Donald Trump and Sputnik News. And we can't in any way rebut or fact check those theories because Nancy Pelosi will not be in Afghanistan. Donald Trump was obviously upset that Pelosi had taken away his opportunity to speak before Congress during the State of the Union, Congress and the Senate. But what would he do? I was wondering about this. What would he do? What would be the counter move? You know, in chess circles, we might call this opening the Queen's Gambit declined. But lo, Ed Henry of Fox suggests the president may have had an opening all his own.
Some of the president's advisors tonight whispering maybe he should break with tradition, deliver his State of the Union on his own terms. Since the Constitution says a speech can be sent in writing to Congress, then the president could turn around and deliver those written remarks from, say, the Oval Office or maybe even the southern border with the Border Patrol and ICE. Remember, he just visited there instead of Capitol Hill on January 29th. Those scenarios being dangled as Pelosi's gambit appears to be backfiring a bit.
Backfiring. Because if the president speaks from a patch of dirt a few thousand miles from the actual seat of power before an audience of Border Patrol agents, a couple of coyotes, meaning both the animals and the human traffickers, and I don't know, maybe some kids from the Boys and Girls Club of Greenwich, Connecticut, because you always got to have the Boys and Girls Club of Greenwich, Connecticut for a speech that is sure to achieve your aims. If he speaks before this assemblage instead of, say, the Supreme Court, both houses of Congress, the military in all their regalia, then I guess he will have owned Nancy. He'll go to the border, which he has been dubbing the very unsafe border, and that will project strength and prestige and oh so much one-upsmanship. And on CNN, Van Jones will finally say this was the day that Donald Trump became president of a Jeff Ross roast special. Who do you think is hurt more at the core, at the very fundamental core of what drives them? Nancy Pelosi denied a trip to a war zone for a war that she has no way to stop, for a war that has proved endless and maybe even embarrassingly so to her, because if you look at the record, she voted for this war, as every member of Congress except Barbara Lee did. So saying Nancy Pelosi can't go and revel in that versus Donald Trump being denied standing at the lectern where every president since Woodrow Wilson was and enjoying all the trappings of office. I'm going to say Trump likes trappings, which might be good because Pelosi seems to now have him trapped. I was really wondering if the Republicans would come up with any cunning counteroffensive. Cunning like a fox, as opposed to the type of cunning as interpreted by Fox, which is not cunning at all, just a dumb idea that gets called clever. Or pretending a pretty good idea from Nancy Pelosi is backfiring when it really is boxing in the president. I remember when Trump's charity was shut down a few, seems like millennia, weeks ago by the Attorney General of New York. And I said to myself, I wonder how savvy the Trump PR team is. Whatever the Trump PR team is, I guess now we've learned it's a fake Michael Cohen is easy on the eyes account and the ghost of Hope Hicks. But I'd have figured that someone on Team Trump would have come up with some sympathetic figure who the Trump Foundation helped, and that person would do the rounds of media, even like-minded media, and say something like, you know, without the help of Mr. Trump and this foundation, I'd be worse off. I don't know, I'd not have had the healing powers of Tim Tebow's helmet to help me along, but just something. But they did nothing. There was no counter-narrative in the media. They couldn't get their acts together to do that. And instead, months later, they come up with this idea. No Afghanistan and no Brussels for you, Nancy. It is enough to get a president branded this.
This is the president essentially being a man baby all over again.
As Michigan Representative Dan Kildee called him, the president is a man baby. That is not nice. And I wonder if the president will now attempt to downgrade Representative Kildee from business class to coach on Spirit Airlines this weekend. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader produced The Gist. They've scheduled a trip home tonight. They're going to take the C train to the G, transfer at Hoyt. Oh, but no, it's been canceled. Shutdown? Yes. Federal shutdown? No. Just the Hoyt Street station for maintenance. These are the real human costs, people. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcasts. She wants us all to know that peripatetism is not a word, but should be. The Gist. Tune in next time for the adventures of Baby Man, the superhero who transforms instantly into a 9-month-old, thwarting crime through tantrums, distractibility, and helplessness. That is the plan anyway. The evil empress holds the knife. Can Baby Man stop her nefarious plans? Oh no! At the last minute, Baby Man is joined by first daughter, the Brush Stash, and introducing Stephen Miller as the Weasel. Join us next time on Baby Man. Oom-pru-dap-ru-du-pru, and thanks for listening.